though barely visible, guided the attackers, who had lain throughout the night hours on the frozen ground, and then, slowly at first, forced their stiffened limbs to follow the whispered commands of their captains, who, in turn, rose up after Blackstone. It was pitch black. The clouds had settled low in the sky. No moon, no stars, only the bobbing white patch on the collar of the man in front. In the silence of the night, all Blackstone heard was the men's rasping breath and the crunch of their weight on the ice. Each footfall sounded like a warning to the night watch on the walls, but he and his men were more than halfway and no alarm had been raised. Men gasped for air as they tried to keep up with Blackstone's long strides, and at every step, as they felt the ice give a little more, they became more desperate to reach the black curtain of the wall that lay ahead. And then they were there. In silence, other than their heaving breath, the men went down on one knee, making themselves less of a target should they be seen. No commands were given. Every man knew what role he played. Raising their eyes, they saw the blind gaze of their dead comrades, hanging from the walls. Contorted in death, their frozen faces told their own story. They had choked to death. No quick release, no snap of the neck, a heel-kicking agony. The ladder went up. Men spat phlegm, got to their feet, gripped their swords, slung their shields across their backs. No longer any need to follow the white patch in front. Shuffling forward, they spread themselves out at the base of the wall, waiting for the ropes to drop, waiting for John Jacob to start the killing. Blackstone's squire went through the window first, knife in hand. The smell of cooked meat lingered in the air. His mouth watered, a sudden pang of hunger, tinged with envy that there was abundant meat for the Lord of Saint-Aubin even in winter. He settled his feet onto the kitchen floor. There was enough fire glow to show the servants' sleeping bodies. Their backs were pressed against the huge hearth, arms tucked into their chests, curled in on themselves for warmth. As in most kitchens, the cooks and servants were men. He took 3 paces into the room, rolling each step onto the side of his foot to lessen any sound of his footfall. There was no need to check whether Perrine and Renfred were behind him. They moved silently, but he could hear their shallow breathing. He stepped past the sleeping bodies and went to the furthest man. 6 men would be dead in seconds. John Jacob's first victim rolled in his sleep. Jacob stopped. Was the man about to wake? The figure coughed and turned to face the hearth. Jacob darted forward, sensed the others do the same behind him, then bent, smothered the man's nose and mouth, cut his blade deep across the man's throat. Warm, sticky blood spurted across his cutting hand. The body bucked. It made no difference. The gurgles of death were each followed by a swift knife to the heart. As the silent killers dispatched the servants, another 3 of Blackstone's men quickly passed them. They ducked out of the door, turned left onto the walkway, up 6 steps to the wallhead defence to drop their ropes to the waiting men below. Perrine ushered Will Longdon through the kitchen. His bow was unstrung, the cord tucked below his skullcap helmet. His sheaf of arrows were still in the waxed cotton bag that the archers had tucked behind their belts into the small of their backs. Once on the walls, the bows would be strung and arrows knocked. The ropes unfurled down the walls. Blackstone and Moulin each took a handhold. One of the men-at-arms took the third. They found purchase and clambered up the roughly hewn stone. 60 feet of heaving effort brought them to the parapet. Sweat soaked their linen shirts beneath their mail, despite the freezing air. Calloused hands cracked from the hardened, rough hemp. The rope men guarded the walkway, but there was no sign of town guards. Blackstone crouched, making his way towards the bridge that would take them across the street below and into the great hall. Men followed him quickly, but as he passed Will Longdon, who was guarding the approach, the archer pointed silently below. The curfew demanded the citizens of Saint-Aubin be off the streets in the hours from sunset to sunrise, but a night lantern and 4 flickering torches spilled light into the square. Their glow cast long shadows from the hanged men and revealed in the middle of the square the half-naked figure of Kilbert. Head slumped on his chest, his knees bent. The unconscious man was bound to a stake by ropes. Blackstone's heart raced. Was Kilbert still alive? That possibility would drive his determination to save his friend, and kill the butcher who had slain so many good men. Blackstone resisted the urge to run down and release his friend. Movement in the torchlight would alert the guards on the other walls. The darkness and the low temperature were Blackstone's best friend. He hoped that the sentries on watch would be huddled in their cloaks, most of them asleep.
"Protect him, Will. Once the alarm is raised, kill anyone who goes near him."
With that simple command, he ran across the walkway above the street and plunged into near darkness as he entered the passageway leading to the great hall. Dim cresset lamps gave enough light for him to see the iron-studded door ahead. He grasped the iron ring latch, turned it slowly, and pressed his shoulder against the door. There were still no cries of alarm from outside, which meant that Blackstone's men had secured the walls. Blackstone, Perrine, and John Jacob moved quickly across the vast expanse of the great hall. The hearth held large logs, which were burning slowly. A long table and benches straddled the room, but no servants slept on the floor or corridor. There was no knowing where de Charité's bedchamber might be, but, as in many older fortifications, Blackstone guessed it would be in a wing off the hall where the latrine tower was built. Blackstone pointed to a handful of torches stacked by the vast stone fireplace. John Jacob and Perrine pushed the oil-soaked torches into the flames. They flared brightly. Flanking Blackstone, they reached the end of the great hall, turned down a passage, and saw stairs winding their way up. This had to be where de Charité's bedchamber was located. The steps curved right to left, and if there were guards at the top, then they had the advantage, because the wall on Blackstone's right hand prohibited the use of a sword. No challenge was issued, however, and at the top of the stairwell, the torchlight revealed the bedchamber's door. Blackstone didn't hesitate as he pushed the door open. The canopy bed was fit for a nobleman, not a Breton warlord. Fresh reeds on the floor cushioned a woven carpet, and a tapestry hung from the walls. There was warmth in the room from a smouldering fire and the smell of stale sweat and sex. The wooden bed frame was decorated with blue and red paint, and the feather mattress's bed coverings were of embroidered cloth. Bernard de Charité had plundered far and wide and lived the life of a wealthy merchant. There was still no movement from the two bodies on the bed. A naked woman lay on her back, arm outstretched, the bedsheets twisted around her torso. Four empty wine bottles lay on the floor, and a burnt-down candle's congealed wax dribbled over a wooden table. The remains of a meal made a squalid mess that spilled onto the floor. Next to the woman, a man lay face down, mouth open, snoring, with spittle dribbling into his beard. His back muscles rose and fell with his heavy breathing. There was no need for Blackstone and the others to be cautious. The butcher of Saint-Aubin was deeply asleep. The three men relaxed their guard. "He's an airy bastard," said Perrine, as he found a bottle that still held some wine. The man's back was smothered in a mat of dark hair, in contrast to his close-cropped head. Perrine offered the bottle to Blackstone, who took a mouthful, passed it back, and then went to the window, where he could see the first hint of daylight creeping into the darkness.
"Like a bear," said John Jacob, lifting the drunken man's sword away from the bench that held his clothing. "And I'll wager he stinks like one." "He lives well," he said, admiring the sword. "Not for long," said Blackstone.
Chapter 6 The town awoke slowly as daylight fought its way through the threatening clouds. The chapel bell for matins clanged tonelessly as men and women, hunched and shivering, staggered into the narrow streets to relieve themselves. There were still many weeks until warmer weather would break up the hard ground underfoot, and water butts would not need their ice broken. It couldn't come soon enough. Sentries on the night watch, who had huddled at their stations throughout the night, shrugged off their cloaks. If the guard commander saw them still hunched when he clambered up the steps to the parapet, then they would be flogged. A woman squatted in the street, her bladder heavy from the long night's curfew. She yawned and blew snot from her nose. Stiff from the unyielding floor that served as her bed, she eased the crick from her neck, her eyes raised towards the high walls. Something dark fell from the sky. Her eyes widened in horror when she saw it was one of the night watch with an arrow through his chest. By the time she had screamed and soiled herself, scrambling to her feet, others had fallen dead into the narrow street.
Will Longdon had set his men in the perfect position to kill the sentries, and as voices raised in panic echoed around the walls, Blackstone's men-at-arms had surged into the barracks next to the town's gate. There, de Chalotet's soldiers were being roused from their sleep, and most died desperately reaching for their weapons, as Moulin and Renfred's men hacked their way through their ranks. A handful of the Breton warlord's men ducked and weaved their way clear of the slaughter. Naked, grasping weapons, they ran into the square, where Will Longdon and six of his archers had already run down to form a defensive line between the unconscious Kilbert and the soldiers' quarters. With practiced ease they bent their bodies, pushing their bow staves away from their chests, hauled back the yard-long, bodkin-tipped arrows, and loosed their deadly shots into the hapless men. Peter Garland did as commanded and killed with the same relentless efficiency as the others, and as the surge of excitement settled, he felt the elation of being part of the elite group of men. Jack Halfpenny had retrieved his war bow and stood with his sentinel. Ignoring the wound in his side, he refused to let the pain from bending the bow stop him from shooting the men who had slain his archers in the ambush. Within minutes of the town's awakening, Blackstone's men had killed most of the 60 men under de Chalotet's command. The townspeople barricaded their doors, but those who had been too slow were forced into the square at sword point, while others had their doors broken down and were dragged into the streets. By the time Blackstone had kicked the naked de Chalotet from his drunken slumber, Jack Halfpenny had cut Kilbert free. Moulin carried him under one of the arches, where others dragged a straw mattress. Renfred and his men seized food and blankets and took them to where Kilbert would be tended. Amid the screams, women ran, dragging their children through the streets, littered with de Chalotet's men, into the charnel house of the square, where Blackstone's dead men still hung. Their men were forced at spear and sword point to follow. The hapless citizens of Saint-Aubin saw roughly dressed figures shouting at each other in English, and stocky men with war bows taller than themselves pulling bloodied arrows from the soldiers who only hours before had made the townspeople feel safe from any attack. Now that illusion had been wrenched from them by sudden violence inflicted by an invader who seemed to have appeared from nowhere. The terrified people were herded ever closer together by Blackstone's men, and watched as a tall, rugged-looking man with a scar on his face dragged the naked Breton warlord into the square. Blackstone clutched de Chalotet by the flesh of his cheek, painfully twisting his face. Despite the Breton's obvious strength, he could not resist because the Englishman would have torn his face from him. With a hefty shove and a kick, the naked man was plunged into the cowering townspeople. Blackstone stood amidst them and looked around at the desecrated bodies of his men hanging from the gibbets. He knew every man's name. He had depended on each of them in battle. Every man had been ready to bleed for the man next to him. His heart thumped hard as if trying to break through the constraints of his leather jerkin. He looked at Moulin, whose glowering expression told him he would cut the throats of every living creature in the town if Blackstone so wished it. Tears stung Blackstone's eyes. He could not express his loss at seeing how his men had died. His voice was no more than a tormented whisper, but its tone carried every threat imaginable to those close enough to hear him. "Get them down, Moulin, and use these bastards to do it." Moulin kicked the men nearest to him, and then, seeing their captain haul terrified townsmen to their feet, the men-at-arms went into the crowd and did likewise. Blackstone pointed at the Breton. "Watch him," he commanded Perrine and John Jacob. "He moves, put a sword to his leg." Blackstone strode on to where Will Longdon attended Kilbert. The veteran knight was now wrapped in a blanket and propped up against the wall. Jack Halfpenny had a rag and a bucket and was finishing wiping the detritus from Kilbert's chest. Kilbert, for his part, was eating a piece of cooked meat and bread and swilling it down with wine. He stared up when Blackstone knelt next to him. "Don't kill him, Thomas. He's mine. I told that dog turd I would kill him, and now I will. I prayed hard for you to come. I knew you would." "Did you doubt it?" "No. But I knew that if Chandos had anything to do with it, I'd have been left to rot." He saw the shadow of the truth cross Blackstone's features. Kilbert grunted. "Aye, I thought as much, though I hold no ill will towards him. I'd have done the same if I were him." Blackstone placed a hand on his friend's shoulder. He had minor wounds, cuts and rope burns from the coarse restraints, and the matted blood on his scalp had been gently bathed away by Halfpenny.
"Rest first, Gilbert, and then you shall have him."
Kildare snapped irritably at the attentive Halfpenny.
"Mother of Christ, lad, I'm not a newborn calf to be rubbed down with straw. Away from me before I take a fist you,"
he spluttered, showering those who attended him with bits of food and spittle. He tossed aside the blanket and forced himself to sit up. Blackstone was unable to suppress a smile.
"It seems being tied to that stake for 4 days was enough of a rest."
"And you took your time. I damn near froze to death, half naked out there, for these inbred peasant scum to hurl shit at me. What were you doing? Whoring? Where have you been?"
The welcome relief of seeing Kilbert's antagonistic spirit again soothed Blackstone's grief.
"Aye, you're right. We were drinking and whoring, and then we had to decide whether to come and see if he was still alive and worth saving."
Kilbert grunted. He watched the townspeople being forced to cut down the men he had lost in the ambush.
"We had no chance, Thomas. We fought as hard as we could, but they overwhelmed us. Christ, they shot down our lads in one fell swoop."
Blackstone helped his friend to his feet as Halfpenny stepped forward, clutching Kilbert's sword belt and clothes.
"Sir Gilbert?"
"We found these in the guard commander's billet. It must have been his reward for launching the ambush."
"Bring him to me, lad. I'll pay him what he deserves."
"We'll put an arrow through his eye. Him and his men, they're all dead," said Halfpenny.
Kilbert spat. "Good riddance, then." He took the clothes without thanks.
"Get yourself away and prod more of those bastards to getting our men off the walls."
The young archer turned away.
"Jack?"
Kilbert called after him. Halfpenny turned.
"You fought well, and I thank you for trying to reach me in the fight. I'm pleased you lived.
Now, get off with you, and once our lads are brought down, attend to your own wound. There's blood seeping."
Halfpenny grinned. Kilbert's gratitude meant more than he would admit.
"And take that stupid grin off your face before these inbreds think you a village idiot," Kilbert demanded.
Kilbert's body shook as he dressed himself, but he pulled back from the help offered by Blackstone.
"I'm not a mewling infant, Thomas.
I was dressing myself when you were not yet a seed in your father's balls."
"You can't fight him now, Gilbert. He's strong, and he has 20 years on you. Young men move fast."
There was still a tremor in Kilbert's fingers as he struggled to close his jupon.
"Thomas, leave me be," he said.
He was concentrating on the task at hand, but his tone of voice left no doubt it was more of a command than a request. "Get that bastard dressed and armed." Chapter 7 3 hours after dawn, a frightened priest did as he was bid at the point of Renfred's sword and rang terse. The German man-at-arms let the nervous priest yank the pull rope long enough for the shrill clanging to irritate, and then prodded him from the gatehouse chapel to where de Charité and Kilbert waited in the square below for absolution before they fought. Kilbert had fortified his weakness with brandy and had spurned Blackstone's offer to fight in his place. As Kilbert tied his sword's blood knot onto his wrist, he turned to Blackstone.
"If he kills me, then you can have him. You've a look in your eyes, Thomas. You seek revenge for the men we lost. I will deliver it."
"These scum hacked them at the end of a rope," Blackstone said, looking to where his men's savaged bodies lay in a line against the wall. "They need to pay for that. Men and women. There's no mercy to be had."
"You don't kill women, Thomas. Never have."
"These towns need to be taught a lesson. I will burn a swathe across this damned country, whether they're held by routiers or French. The king still has a price on my head. By the time I'm finished, he'll have so many heads in sacks he can rule over their corpses."
"Merciful Christ, Thomas! You'll become a monster if you slay everyone in this town."
"I will become what they say I have always been." He gestured to the approaching priest. "God be with you, Gilbert."
He stood back as Kilbert pulled on his helm and strode forward. There was little doubt that Kilbert was the more experienced fighter, but de Charité was years younger, and the man's strength was obvious from his barrel chest and thick neck muscles. There was a wolfish grin on the Breton's face as he approached the middle of the square. In his mind he had already beaten the weakened veteran knight. The Chalotet bent down on one knee and took the priest's blessing. A short confession, and he was absolved from his sins. He stood back and pulled on his helm, waiting as Kilbert faced the priest, who looked uncertain because the Englishman had not bent his knee. "You're in my way, priest," said Kilbert.
"My lord, you must be shriven."
"I have confessed a lifetime of sins to many priests before many battles, but I have no intention of dying today."
"Do you fear your sins will not be forgiven by contrition, because your conscience bites at your soul?"
said the priest uncertainly.
"Get out of the way."
But Kilbert pushed the stammering priest to one side and advanced. Bernard de Charité hesitated, stunned that Kilbert would dare refuse God's blessing.
"Prepare yourself, Breton turd. By tomorrow your head will be spilled from a sack in front of your king."
De Charité slammed down his visor, raised his sword at the high guard and swung the blade. Feet braced at an angle, the power from his shoulders and chest bringing enough strength to bear to cleave a man from shoulder to hip. As he watched his friend, Blackstone involuntarily shifted his weight, as if he were fighting instead of Kilbert.
Half step. Turn and thrust.
"Gilbert, he has you."
As de Chalotet's blade swept downward, Kilbert did not flinch. He made a subtle shift of his body's angle, and the Breton's sword tip whispered past his face and chest. It was a movement made by an expert fighter whose instinct, as much as his eyes, told him where a sword blade would fall. The crowd gasped. De Chalotet's impetuousness carried him past Kilbert, who made no attempt to strike. He waited, shifting the weight on the balls of his feet, as a disbelieving de Chalotet quickly corrected his balance, turned and attacked again. This time Kilbert caught the strike on his own blade, turned it with a two-handed twist, and felt the Breton shuffle his weight, ready to use the advantage of his strength against him. The crowd stayed silent, afraid to support their lord, but Blackstone's men roared for Kilbert. Blackstone glanced at John Jacob. They knew how skilled Kilbert was in a fight, but he was weak. He would be unable to withstand a sustained attack. Blackstone turned his head towards where he had positioned Will Longdon. The archer held his bow down, an arrow already knocked, his fingers on the cord. If Kilbert looked as though he was going to be killed, Blackstone could never reach him in time. It would need the speed of an arrow to save Kilbert's life. Blackstone shook his head at the sentinel's questioning look.
"Not yet. Wait."
Kilbert took a backward step. It seemed ill-advised because de Chalotet braced his left leg, drew back his sword, threw forward his weight and lunged. Kilbert couldn't avoid the strike. Blackstone was about to signal Will Longdon when Kilbert suddenly swiveled on the balls of his feet, twisted his hips, reversed his sword, and struck de Chalotet's helm with the pommel. The Breton's heels rocked. The blow snapped back his neck, and Kilbert used his free hand to grab his opponent's sword belt and tip him backwards. De Chalotet's legs splayed, his sword arm reaching out against the impact of hitting the ground. It happened fast. A roar of disbelief surged from the crowd as Kilbert kicked back the man's visor with his heel, and then rammed the point of his blade deep into the fallen man's chest. It cut through cloth, mail, and flesh. De Chalotet squirmed, but Kilbert was leaning all his weight onto the sword's pommel. The Breton's strength nearly threw Kilbert off as he bucked and floundered, but the veteran knight knew how to kill, and his blade could not be dislodged. The Lord of Saint-Aubin screamed, eyes wide in pain and terror, his gaze locked onto the grimacing features of the man who had promised that his face would be the last thing he saw before he died. His eyes dimmed, and the gurgling in his throat from the choking blood stopped. Kilbert wrenched free his sword and pulled off his helm, hands shaking from the fight's effort.
"I vow to take him limb from limb," he said to Blackstone, who stepped quickly to his friend. "But I was too damn tired."
The Breton warlord's head was severed and wrapped in a sack. Blackstone would send the priest north to Paris to deliver the gruesome message that Saint-Aubin was lost and that a favoured ally of the war in Brittany had been slain. De Chalotet's men's corpses had been unceremoniously thrown into their billet, as Blackstone ordered the people of Saint-Aubin to strip wood from their homes and livestock byres. He walked the base of the town's walls, letting his stonemason's eye seek out a weakness. He found it in the north wall that abutted the lake. Over the years, the dank conditions had weakened the rubble stone used in its construction. The wall had been built in two layers, with loose rubble and dirt between them. Blackstone ordered that everything that could burn be stacked along its length. Tar barrels were placed at the base of the wall, and casks of oil emptied over the wood. Blackstone was going to burn the place to the ground. The cold persisted, but it was fear that made the townspeople shiver as Blackstone looked down on them from the top of the steps leading up to the parapet walkway. The Lord of Saint-Aubin le Fur was given the chance to fight for his life, but those who had sport with my men will die. A fearful moan rose from the upturned faces. They jostled each other like penned sheep, but there was no escape. John Jacob, Perrine, and Kilbert flanked Blackstone. The squire cast a nervous look at his sworn lord. Blackstone's anger was as unyielding as the frozen lake beyond the walls. He was going to teach the town a lesson, and John Jacob feared that he was about to order the slaughter of all the townspeople. Will Longdon's archers were stationed on the ramparts, and the men-at-arms, shields up, stood in a line ready to advance on the unarmed folk. Three men in the crowd looked nervously at each other and then took faltering steps forward.
"My lord," said the eldest, "we serve on the council, and with your permission we will speak on behalf of the people of Saint-Aubin."
Blackstone gave a curt nod.
"Thank you, Sir Thomas. For years we have lived in fear of routiers," continued the man. "They scorched everything for miles around. It was only the protection of Bernard de Charité that allowed us to sleep safely in our beds."
The second man in the delegation splayed his palms in supplication.
"For years the English king took what he wanted. The war he fought destroyed France. We had nothing, only our town. It is where we are born and where we belong. It is the only place any of us have known. Our children are our only wealth."
A murmur of agreement rippled through the crowd. The third elder dared to step closer to Blackstone.
"Sir Knight, we had agreed with heavy hearts to deliver our beloved home to King Edward, but Lord de Charité convinced us that it would be a grave mistake, that the English would inflict pain on us in their victory."
He bowed his head, clasping his hands together, voice faltering.
"That we behaved so vilely towards the dead cannot be excused. It shames us, but our lord urged us to wreak our own revenge on them, so that we might free ourselves of the burden that has crushed our hearts for so many years. We vented our suppressed fear, and that was wrong. Our true guilt is of being frightened by fighting men such as yourselves."
The three men fell silent. Blackstone showed no sign of mercy.
"You will pay, every one of you," he said coldly.
A wail of grief rose from the crowd. Women clutched their children to them as menfolk embraced their women. Their death was imminent, exactly as de Charité had predicted. Kilbert turned and spoke quietly to Blackstone.
"Thomas, think a moment on this. Your rage is understandable. The years of war and your own suffering can close a man's heart to mercy. How often have we seen and heard our king vow to inflict terror on a town or a city that has defied him? It was only the tender words of his queen who softened his anger and made him relent. You loved Christiana when you were still a boy archer. Think of her now. Your wife may be dead, Thomas, but I know she still speaks to your heart."
Blackstone had still not turned his eyes away from the whimpering crowd. Kilbert gently touched his friend's arm.
"I, more than anyone, wish to strike these people down, but we gain no honour from it, and honour is all we have left in our desolate lives. To kill them in the name of our king serves no purpose, other than to inflame hatred against him. You've always had a place of tenderness in your heart. Find it again."
Blackstone finally turned to face his friend and spoke quietly.
"I am no monster, Gilbert. I would never slay women and children, but an example must be made, you know that. What would you have me do, walk away?"
Kilbert remained silent. Blackstone was right. The English king had won the peace, and that which was ceded to him needed to be claimed.
and those who betrayed his trust risked everything. Do what you did when we seized Bannon after our fight at Reims, before the king signed the treaty. Blackstone glanced at him. They had captured the town of Bannon the previous year and punished those who had tortured a woman thought to be a witch. Blackstone faced the crowd. The ground is as hard with frost as my heart is with revenge. You will dig until your hands bleed, men and women both, and you will bury my men, and your priest will pray over them. 40 men died. I will take a tithe. You choose, he said, looking at the town elders. 4 men to hang. That is the mercy I, Thomas Blackstone, grant you in the name of my king for the betrayal and mutilation. The spokesmen nodded their acceptance. Men grimaced at the thought of who might be chosen. Women wept, and the children whimpered, not understanding what grieved their parents. And when this has been done, said Blackstone, I will destroy Saint-Aubin, La Fleur. Chapter 8 The pall of smoke hovered above the blazing town, a black shroud heavy in the air. It took a day, and into that night, for the men, women, and children to bury Blackstone's slaughtered men, and then, as the dawn broke, he allowed them to gather what they could carry. 4 bodies swung from a gibbet 50 yards from the main gate, as the stream of people shuffled their way clear of the blazing buildings and the decapitated body of Bernard de Charité that hung from the ankles alongside the men who had been sacrificed. The townspeople's homes had been destroyed, and the corpses of de Charité's men had been laid in the pyre once anything of use had been stripped from them. Being garrison soldiers, their boots were less worn than those of Blackstone's men. As the inferno took hold, the flames soared up through the tower keep and ignited the timber frame roof like a beacon that would be seen for miles. Blackstone's men loaded supplies stripped from the town after he had allowed every family enough food for a week. Blackstone and his men sat at the forest edge, their horses shifting weight, snorting breath, and watched the procession of dispossessed with the smoke billowing behind them.
No one town will take them all in, said John Jacob.
They'll split into groups and find sanctuary, said Blackstone.
They'll tell the others what we have done, said Kilbert, and that will put the fear of Christ into them.
He glanced at Blackstone. If any of them survive, they'll fall prey to routiers now, Thomas. They'll be slaughtered out in the open.
They paid the price, Gilbert.
We'll shadow and protect them.
That will give them another story to tell. Fear and gratitude work like a horse pulling a cart.
You confuse even me at times, Kilbert said with a grin. You never intended to harm them, did you?
And you let me splutter on like a damned wet nurse imploring you to halt any slaughter.
Blackstone smiled. I needed the terror in their hearts, Gilbert.
But Chandos and the king will curse you, Thomas. They wanted Saint-Aubin.
It is of no strategic importance to anyone now, Gilbert. Its destruction serves a greater purpose. When these people tell their story, they will exaggerate every deed and word spoken as surely as any drunkard in a tavern embellishes a tale, and the other towns will surrender without complaint. They'll hand over the keys and swear the loyalty demanded.
The men continued to watch as the column of people disappeared from view. The intense heat from the flames melted the frost on the branches behind them, and as the slow crackle of breaking ice echoed across the lake, a louder sound began to be heard. It was the death throes of an ancient town, a place that had withstood siege over the centuries and witnessed the passing of armies. The foundations of the walls were crumbling, the masonry yielding to the searing heat. The men gasped as they witnessed the 50-foot-high wall collapse from its base and then fold in on itself. Debris from the rough stone infill scattered onto the crumbling ice. The gaping wound that had been the north wall was suddenly cauterized by sheets of fire. Some of the horses shied and were quickly brought under control, but Blackstone's horse's ears pricked forward. It showed no sign of fear at the gush of flame. Blackstone grunted. Perhaps it was true that the bastard horse had been sired in hell.
He jabbed his heels and turned it away. The destruction was complete. The peace was proving as violent as the war. The priest had been given a broken-down Rouncy to carry him and his grisly message to Paris and the French king. The nag's uneven gait threw the pot-bellied cleric from side to side, its bony ribs rubbing his thighs raw. Muttered prayers mingled with every heavenly curse he could muster against the scar-faced Englishman who had sent him on this errand. The blood-soaked sack, tied across the horse's loins, had dried stiff, but a haunting noise had started to wear down the priest's nerves. At first it sounded as though the nag's joints were creaking, but when the priest let his mind settle on the sound behind him, a stark fear clutched his heart. The noise was coming from the sack. The dead man was speaking to him in a subdued, distorted voice. Heart thudding, the priest hauled the horse to a halt and listened, but the sound had stopped. Heeling the horse forward, the grinding began again. The priest squeezed closed his eyes, clasped his hands together, and prayed harder than the day he had been given the benefice of Saint-Aubin. Once again he brought the horse to a halt, and, like a man scared of something unknown creeping up behind him, eased himself down onto the ground. The moment his sandals touched the muddy track, he sank to his knees and prayed. Moments later the Almighty gave him courage. With eyes still closed, he teased the encrusted string and untied the sack. Finally he dared to open his eyes and gaze down. Bernard de Charité's milky eyes stared back at him, his face leering in a broken grin. Mesmerized, the priest gently tilted the sack and then laughed, releasing the pent-up tension in his chest.
"Ah, my lord, you struck even more fear into me in death than you did in life."
The rocking of the horse had dislodged the severed head's jaw, and the grating sound was that of the lower teeth grinding against the upper.
"What's that, my lord? You would beat and curse me again if you could?"
He had endured more than one flogging at the Lord of Saint-Aubin's hands.
"I cause you discomfort. It was not I who put you in the sack, and the man who did commands me to take you to those you serve. I do penance at every step of the journey. My ass is as raw as your neck."
The priest's nervousness gave way to distaste for his task, and loathing for the dead Bernard de Charité.
"You died too easily," he whispered vehemently, "died without enough pain being inflicted on you for the sins you committed in your whoring life. I pray the legions of Lucifer await you in hell to inflict their punishment."
With a gesture that astonished him in its spontaneity, he spat into the upturned face. His action made him recoil, and he quickly closed the sack and crossed himself.
"Merciful Christ, forgive me for desecrating the dead," he said.
"What lunacy is this, priest?" said a voice behind him.
The priest whirled and faced a horde of armed horsemen who stood 20 paces away. He had not heard them approach. His mouth gaped. There were at least 30 men-at-arms. Behind them, even more followed, until they were more dense than the forest that had hidden them.
"The deranged are always with us," said the tall, barrel-chested man.
He eased his horse forward.
"Whether their voice is satanic or heavenly."
He spoke with a strange accent, but the words that escaped through the thick mass of grey beard were clear enough to be heard by the hundreds of men behind him. How had they moved so silently, wondered the priest. How had he not heard a jangle of a bridle or the creak of leather and mail? Fear of what he held in his hands had closed the world around him. That and the fact that they had approached downwind, fighters who knew how to get close to an enemy.
"Which is yours?" said the horseman. "A voice of God or the mutterings of the devil?"
The priest stuttered, mind racing for an answer, as the rider stepped down from the saddle. He stood as tall as the scar-faced Englishman who had destroyed the town, but he was older, with an almost white mane of thick shoulder-length hair. The man's calloused hands that reached for the sack sported delicate silver and gold rings in contrast to flattened and scarred knuckles. A man who knew how to use his fists, decided the priest. He gave up the sack without protest. The fighting man spoke with a calm assurance, almost conversationally, as if speaking to a child who had been given a gift.
"Now, what have we here?"
The man-at-arms pushed back his cloak and opened the sack. He showed no sign of surprise, nor did he recoil. The blood on the sack had already given its warning.
"Who is this?"
The priest's throat dried as he glanced fearfully from the man on foot to those who still sat unsmiling on horseback. A ravening horde of routiers, if he had ever seen one.
"My lord, it is the master of Saint-Aubin-le-Feu, Bernard de Charité."
"Ah," said the quietly spoken man, "too late then. I was summoned by him to bring my men and help him resist the English and the pretender to Brittany. A pity. He promised sacks full of gold coin. Instead, he gazes up at me from one."
He tied the sack closed and handed it back to the priest.
"He had a fierce reputation. Who was strong enough to do this?"
The priest found his courage and his voice again. Now that the barbarian, for that is what every routier was at heart, had declared his loyalty to the dead man, he found common purpose.
"A man at arms, a knight who fights for England and his violent, grasping king."
He raised his voice and addressed the horseman as if he were delivering a sermon.
"Who accompanies a man possessed by both the devil and archangel, so that he inflicts harsh punishment on one hand and compassion on the other, a double-edged sword that gouges a man's soul and sends him stumbling confused into the unknown away from the hearth that has nurtured him, like a spiritually blinded man."
The man-at-arms sighed and placed a heavy hand on the priest's shoulder to curtail any further incomprehensible rhetoric.
"Who?"
The priest flinched.
"Sir Gilbert Gilbert struck my lord down in single combat."
The routier's chin tilted in recognition.
"Gilbert? And the other?"
"Sir Thomas Blackstone."
Once again the man's eyes indicated recognition.
"And where are they now?"
The priest pointed, arm shaking.
"South, past what remains of Saint-Aubin. If you are a compatriot of de Charité, then you can avenge him. They are less than 100 strong, and you have..."
The priest stumbled as he tried to calculate the press of horsemen.
300,
the routier grinned.
"Three,"
the priest said, swallowing hard. This was one of the biggest bands of routiers he had seen.
"Then, my lord, ride on and follow the smoke, and in the name of God and the dispossessed people of Saint-Aubin, slay those who inflicted such misery on us, and leave their carcasses for the crows."
Chapter 9 3 days after the destruction of Saint-Aubin-le-Feu, Blackstone and his men waited a mile beyond another town's walls. The citizens of Saint-Aubin knelt at its gates and begged entry. Their elders stood before the town's council and declared their misfortune. They behaved exactly as expected. With gestures of ever-increasing passion, they wept and bemoaned their fate and pointed to where Blackstone's men waited. Within hours, the gates were opened and Blackstone rode into the town to take the oath of allegiance from the chief citizens. They were promised that the town would lose none of its privileges, and that the regional lord and his men would serve as seneschal and guardians, with the assurance of help from the English king. Blackstone appointed the local lord as garrison commander, ordered that King Edward's arms be painted above the gate, and reappointed the town's officials. "We are little more than debt collectors," moaned Kilbert as they rode towards the next town. "When you were a boy and a knock on the head away from being the village idiot, I was riding across Lord Malden's domain doing exactly this, collecting debts from villeins."
"I was caring for my brother and working in a quarry," said Blackstone, "to earn every penny that was demanded."
"Well," Kilbert sighed, "they were good days, days that took us to war. The best war a man could wish for, better than this. Anything is better than this. Now I collect towns for the king. Where in God's name is Chandos? We need an army to strike at the French. Mark my words, Thomas, the French king is gathering troops. We should ride north towards Paris and put an end to his dreams of glory and stop his men from even leaving the suburbs."
"North? And into the plague,"
said Blackstone. "The pestilence takes its toll in England and Paris. Better to stay out here." He turned his face to the fine rain that fell and kept his men hunched beneath their cloaks. Snot dripped from Kilbert's nose. "When a man fights, Thomas, he cares nothing for foul weather, but when he is asked to be an errand boy, misery clutches at his heart. Let's go and find some of the Breton bastards who challenge our king and get the blood moving through our veins." Blackstone ignored his friend's suggestion and glanced behind him at the column of men. "Will, the archers Sir John gifted us, they're little more than lads." Will Longdon wiped the rain from his face.
"Untested, Thomas. Strong enough. Decent pull weights on their bows, but untested. New recruits. They'll be all right. At least he didn't give us Welsh bowmen. God's blood. They can argue for the sake of it and drive a man to pull a knife. I gave half of these new lads to Jack Halfpenny. Jack will bring them into line."
"And John?"
"What about the men-at-arms?" he asked John Jacob. "Moulon says they're scum, but they seem willing enough. Most are pardoned men. The king needed fighting men, so he emptied the prisons, and this is where some of them have ended up. I have my lads keeping an eye on them. I've warned them that they're following you now, and we don't tolerate certain things."
Blackstone turned to Kilbert. "You've seen them. You've walked among them when we camped. Do you think they're ready for a fight?" Kilbert put a finger to each nostril and blew them clear. "You throw them into a brawl, and they'll learn soon enough. I remember you on your first kill. You were puking like a dog, but you learned quick enough. You had the instinct even back then. You saw how things were, how to attack and where. Most of them will do all right when the time comes. Don't bother the youngsters, Thomas. I know Henry's not here to fuss over."
"Is that what I did?" he said,
his son's image in his mind's eye. "Aye, now and then. The lad took risks, but he used his noggin. You give these boys a chance, and they won't let you down, not with Jack and Will at their backs. And Moulin will cut the throat of any man who disobeys and rapes." Blackstone knew Kilbert was nudging him not to be so cautious with untried archers, using Blackstone's son Henry to make his point. The boy had saved their lives a year ago in Milan, when Blackstone sought his vengeance against the Visconti, and now the lad was studying in Florence under the guidance of Father Niccolò Torellini. Blackstone's memory prodded him. It was a self-same priest who had held him when he was a badly wounded 16-year-old archer on the field at Crecy. Held him and blessed him and given him absolution because his injuries were so bad he was close to death. 16. His own son was not yet that, but had shown courage years before he had any right to be tested.
"All right, Gilbert. I'll let Jack and Will command those lads when the time comes. But until it does, we do the king's bidding. Chandos has a fight waiting for us, so there's time to train them. I won't have my men killed because they're not ready."
Before Kilbert could answer, the bastard horse's muscles rippled, ears forward, its head rose, pulling on the reins. Blackstone raised a hand and halted the column behind him.
"Something's wrong," he said,
trusting the feral stallion's instincts even above his own. They had crested a gently rising hill and made their way into the belly of lower ground. Ahead and to their right flank, the edge of a forest followed the gently undulating contours. There was no need for Blackstone's men to question why he had brought them to a halt. The ground suggested a perfect place for an ambush from the curving forest 350-yard-long paces away. The men cast off the chill from their muscles and eased aside their capes. Without being ordered, Moulon and John Jacob eased their mounts to either side of Blackstone and Kilbert, and as they took position, Will Longdon and Jack Halfpenny had quietly signalled their archers to dismount and take up position to the front of them. Every fourth man took three horses each and moved them to the rear. Within minutes, Blackstone's men had prepared for an attack. Birdsong had fallen silent. No rooks or crows cawed from the dark thatch of their nests in the tall treetops, and yet the whisper of breeze that brushed the men's faces brought no warning of danger. Bridles jangled as the horses patiently stood their ground, but the bastard horse whinnied and bunched its muscles, forcing Blackstone to sit back in the saddle and tighten the reins. Kilbert glanced behind them. They would never be able to make the higher ground back there. There had been no sign in the wet grass of anyone ahead of them,
so if there were enemy on their flank, they had kept themselves in the forest for as long as Blackstone's men had been riding in their direction.
"Chandos, do you think?"
said Kilbert quietly. "He'd have shown himself as soon as we came over the hill," said Blackstone. He drew Wolf's sword, its blade scraping loud with intent on its scabbard's metal rim. Moments later, every man-at-arms did the same. The forest's treetops erupted in a black swarm of screeching crows. Wings flapping, they cried their alarm as the forest edge wavered and splashes of colour emerged from the dull tree-line. The breeze barely lifted the banners and the cut tongues of pennons that followed. Armoured men on war horses were flanked by men-at-arms.
"French," said Kilbert, as ever more men emerged from the forest.
"Christ, how many are there?"
200 at least, said Blackstone. "Probably more in reserve, unless this is just an advance party."
Kilbert glanced at Blackstone's men.
"That's all right, then. For a moment I was worried we might be outnumbered." He grinned at Blackstone. "God's blood, Thomas, the bastards have us."
The French had moved across the valley floor and lined up for attack. No challenge had been made, no demand for withdrawal. The French were hunting for routiers and meant to kill.
"Whose banner is that?" said Blackstone.
Kilbert squinted as the horsemen turned into formation.
"That's the Marshal of France. Dordrehem's men.
The French king must think he's the only one who can seize the prize that he's missed all these years."
"He's not after me, Gilbert. He's clearing out routiers. He doesn't know who we are. He hasn't seen our blazon, and he won't have come from Saint-Aubin."
Blackstone studied the line of men that faced them. "He's an impetuous fool," he said.
"You remember that he charged our lines at Poitiers and failed?"
"Aye, he wants glory. Let him come, then. Will and the lads will cause some pain, and then we can get among them." The line of French horsemen bristled as they tightened reins and jostled, their front rank knee to knee.
"Stupid bastards. Never learn," said John Jacob. "Our archers will cut them down."
"But there's enough of them to finish us," said Blackstone. Before the French line began their advance, the sky darkened on the crest of the rising ground to Blackstone's left flank. Horsemen appeared and drew up their horses. It was obvious that the men were in force. At least 200 more, realized Blackstone. Kilbert spat.
"Now we might have a problem."
Blackstone knew he couldn't fight that many. There was no retreat, and the horsemen on his flank would have cut off any such attempt. The French had cornered him at last, like a wolf in a trap. He shunned the brief moment of realization that death was imminent. He was grateful his son was in a place of safety and that he would carry on his name. Blackstone heeled the bastard horse.
"Those horsemen on the ridge will hold off, Gilbert. They won't risk getting close to our archers. They'll stay out of it. Dordrehem's men are enough to finish us."
Blackstone nudged his horse, fighting the bit, forward, and then turned to face his men. Will Longdon had placed his and Halfpenny's archers in a sawtooth formation between the men-at-arms ranks, arrows pushed into the dirt at their feet. There was little need for Blackstone to raise his voice as he addressed them.
"We're caught," said Blackstone. "We can surrender, and the French will hang every one of us. And then our heads will be on poles at the gates of Paris."
He unslung his shield from its saddle ties and settled it on his arm. Its blazon of a gauntleted fist gripping the cruciform sword beneath its cross guard was decorated with the legend, "Défaillant à la mort." He looked down to where the youngest archers stood under Halfpenny's command. Fear etched their faces. Their bodies trembled. They had never faced a cavalry charge of armoured knights before.
"We will attack, but if their horsemen get past us, then you boys look to Will Longdon and Jack Halfpenny. They will show you courage. Obey their commands, and you will kill many Frenchmen before they kill us."
His eyes swept across the extended line of his men.
"We have danced with death many times."
He hit the flat of Wolfsword's blade across his shield.
"No surrender," he called.
His men roared and brought down their blades across their shields. Like a crack of lightning, the sound echoed across the open ground.
"No surrender!"
Fear had been rammed down into their chests and smothered with belligerence that gave them the strength to kill and the courage to face their death. Blackstone kicked his heels and let loose the surging horse as the men, little more than a handful, roared their defiance. Chapter 10 Blackstone hunched low over his horse's withers, shield raised, sword held low, ready to make the first upward cutting blow into the nearest enemy's leg or raised sword arm, mortal blows that would soon kill. A severed leg or arm flooded blood and seeped bone marrow. In this brutal, unforgiving contest, strength and endurance would be the only thing to keep a man alive, that and the blessing of any angel of war that hovered at his shoulder. The goddess of the silver wheel, Arianhod, jangled on a leather cord at Blackstone's throat. She was an archer's Celtic charm, a pagan spirit who offered protection. When the time came to forsake him, she would ease the fighting man's spirit across the darkening sky. The bowman's guardian angel pressed close to the small gold crucifix that his wife had given him when they were little more than children. A blessing from her to protect the man she already loved. The front line of French horsemen seemed to waver, uncertain what to do as Blackstone's men hurled themselves forward. Those behind who bore the banners and pennons of the French knights and of the Marshal of France had already turned in retreat. Something was wrong. Blackstone was less than 100 yards from the front ranks when they too turned their horses. It meant only one thing. The French had drawn in Blackstone and then turned for the forest, where they would reform and outflank him. The killing would be done by those hundreds of horsemen who waited on the hillside. A charge downhill into Blackstone's ranks would force him back straight onto French swords. Hope lay in Will Longdon's archers, ready to loose their arrows on those men on the high ground should they attack Blackstone's flank. The French seemed to be in turmoil. Many had already galloped into the woodland. Blackstone dared to glance over his shoulder, thundering horses, bellowing lungs, his own men snarling, faces contorted in savage determination. A part of Blackstone's memory heard the words of his king from a lifetime ago, when they faced the enemy host at Crecy. Blackstone, the boy archer, had trembled with fear as King Edward extolled French courage and ferocity. Furor Franciscus. He had never forgotten those words, nor that Edward assured the English of victory. Now it was Blackstone's men whose ferocity had turned French ranks, and the horsemen on the rising ground had still not spurred their horses. Blackstone's horse barged a French man-at-arms' mount as he struggled to heel it away from the English charge. The horseman swung wildly, but Blackstone had struck him on his blind side. The man had no means of delivering a blow. Wolf's sword's blade almost severed the man's left leg behind the knee. The razor-sharp edge cut through flesh, bone and tendon, and then went on to slash into the horse's flank. Screams of pain rent the air as Blackstone's men bludgeoned their way into their enemy. As Blackstone's momentum carried him through the French front ranks, the bastard horse, swinging its huge head like a pole hammer, he realized that those Frenchmen who had first retreated into the forest were now slowing those behind them, making their own desperate bid to escape. The forest had clawed at the French as surely as ranks of spearmen on the battlefield. There were barely 40 men left to fight. A dozen French horsemen scattered, riderless horses from those already slain ran after them. Chaos was Blackstone's friend as the remaining men-at-arms were killed. Kilbert's flail brought down a young horseman. He quickly got to his knees and threw open his arms in surrender, but Perrine was at Kilbert's shoulder and had already swung down with a killing blow. Crazed horses, nostrils flaring from effort and the stench of blood, barged and pushed into each other. John Jacob heeled his horse between Blackstone and a Frenchman who had managed to bring his mount under control. As the man raised himself in the saddle to strike down on Blackstone's helm, Jacob lunged, his sword point ramming into the man's exposed thigh and the soft flesh of his buttock. The man's head threw back, then spasmed as he vomited. He slumped, defenceless, his horse once again out of control as it surged away. The man held on for 30 yards and then fell into the grass. He writhed, wounded leg pulled tightly into his chest, his screams rising above others who were in their death throes. One of Blackstone's men had gone after the wounded horseman and quickly dismounted. Blackstone didn't recognize him or his name. It was one of the men gifted by Chandos. The man-at-arms put his foot against the wounded man's throat and stabbed down into the defenseless man's other leg. He struck again into the man's shoulder, ensuring the downed man would know even more pain before he died. Once again he plunged his blade, not yet delivering the killing blow. Blackstone spurred his horse forward, and as the gloating killer was about to hack again into the downed man, struck him across his helmet with the flat of Wolfsword's blade. The blow threw the man down, and by the time he staggered to his feet, Blackstone had dismounted and was standing over him. The man spat blood and cursed.